This episode covers topics of suicide, transphobia, homophobia, sexual assault, and deportation. Listener discretion is advised. Before we begin this episode, we would like to give a shout out to our patrons on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems, especially Jen, Daniel, Audrey, Natalie, Danielle, Saul, Maria, Luis, Edis, and Kimberly. If you'd like to support this podcast in return for awesome rewards, it really helps us keep this thing going. You can do so at patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. All right, let's start the show.
We'll do it live. We'll do it live!
Fuck it!
Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live! Fucking thing sucks!
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Bitter Brown Fams. I am your host, Ruben.
And this is Cassandra.
And we are back after a month. What have you been up to?
It hasn't been a month. Has it? It's always been. We do monthly recordings and, you know, it is what it is. But it's also on September 5th of last year, we released our first episode. So it's been a year for Bitter Brown Femmes. And we want to thank everybody who has listened to us along the way and supported us. But we're still here and we hope to have another awesome year ahead of us.
Indeed. So what has been going on with you recently?
A lot. I was talking to you earlier about how we're in Virgo season now, and my moon is in Virgo, so I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do well during during Virgo season, and then I forget that Virgos, you know, just work. So it's been stressful going back to school. I went back to school, my son went back to school, and I had mentioned on the last episode how I moved out, so I've been adjusting to that and also trying to just get settled and buy things that I need. I don't know, I guess just kind of adapting to like being in a new house and a new schedule, right? Because it's like over the summer I was just working, but now it's like work, school, and whatever else comes up. So it's been stressful. How has your Virgo season been?
Productive. Mm-hmm. Productive. I've like shot episodes for the other podcast I'm working on developing, Chithmology Anthology. Those were like at the end of Leo season, but I'm like editing them now. And yeah, it's not gonna take away from this podcast at all. It's just gonna be like, I wanna talk about art and like writing and like things that, and like politics, like it goes in social justice and all that shit affects like art, but I feel like I just wanted to talk about it more with like specific people. And so like that's kind of what the other podcast is going to be about, talking with cultural creators. So I interviewed Louis, who is a creator of the Gran Barones, which is like one of the first online spaces that I really knew for like queer and trans Latinos, Chicanos. And then I interviewed Anthony J. Williams, who's like a sociologist, abolitionist, speaker. So that was really dope. So those are going to be my first two episodes, and they'll be out soon. I've also been working on like getting like the first videos for my YouTube channel like up and like running. So by the time this goes live, it'll probably be, the YouTube channel will probably be live. So that's exciting. Virgo's always like work, work, work. Like it's never like, it's a season of like organization, right? Mm-hmm. Like Virgo is ruled by like neatness, right? And so it's been just like hustling. Like I am always like on, like I'm always reading. I'm always like, cause sometimes what I like, for example, like my first video is going to be on like Sesta Fosta, like talking about it thoroughly, but it went from like talking about the law to just talking about like a lot of other issues around it. And so it's just been a lot of work.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to that. So now I can finally have a podcast listen to that is in hours.
Oh my God. Listen to fucking other podcasts already.
I do not want to. You can't make me. But yeah, Virgo season is just work and getting your shit together. Like, I feel like I have been getting my life in order. Like, things that I've been saying all year, like, oh, I'm going to do that. I should do that. Like, I'm finally, like, doing it. So I guess that's an upside. Let's see what else has been going on in my life. Just a lot of stress. I've been dealing. It's funny because on our last episode, I had mentioned like, oh yeah, I'm like ready to fight like my son's teachers or school, and like I actually didn't have been doing that, and it's barely like the third or fourth week of school, so that's been stressful. Yeah, just navigating like the school system as like a parent. My son, you know, he is considered a special education student, so I've been having to kind of advocate for him and what I think is best for him, and also trying to be like, am I just being a mom, right? Am I just like not thinking? Also trying to understand like where teachers are coming from, especially because I'm going to be a teacher, and I also understand that we fucking don't pay teachers enough for what they do and like overwork them, and they don't have a lot of resources that they should have, right? So yeah, kind of like juggling all that out. So, but it's okay for now. And yeah,
that's a lot.
That was a lot.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
That they have to go through that. Like every time, like Everybody around me is like pregnant, so like, it's made me think about like, oh shit, I'm like turning 30. Like, is this not like baby season or something, like time? And then I'm like thinking about like, holy shit, what if they grow up and then I gotta fight people all the time? And then I'm just like, that's just so much that I don't know that if I'm equipped to handle.
It is,
especially like I would always be anxious of like, oh my god, like, they're gonna fucking croak like in public. Like, I don't know. I'd just be so anxious about the world that I don't think I can ever have children.
Yeah, that's how I've been feeling lately. Cause I guess I've been thinking like my son has like he doesn't really have a diagnosis right now, but they kind of throw like they tested him for autism without my consent last year, which was like a big thing. And then they kind of like, well, in the future, we'll see if he has ADD or ADHD. And those are things that, like, I feel if he's autistic or has ADD or anything, like, we will deal with that at that time, right? But right now, because he doesn't have these things, it's kind of just, like, it feels like he's, like, you know when, like, you just label a student, like, a quote-unquote bad student? That's what it feels like with my son, like, because he has this paperwork since he was like three that follows him, they kind of just want to not deal with it. Like, oh, well, we'd rather just place him in this class away from everybody else, right? And that's what it feels like. And then I was thinking about this student that when I was in fourth grade, there was like, and I'm sure we all know, like, remember these, I don't know, these kids in our class that we had that were like the quote unquote bad student, but they weren't really bad. They just had short attention span, or they did have a hard time concentrating or whatever. And in fourth grade, I remember the student in our class that was like the problematic child, like our teacher threw like a desk at him. Yeah. And it's wild when I think about it now, like she asked us all to step out of the class, and then she was just like yelling at him, like ugly yelling. And like we heard like a desk, but like no one knew about it. Like, I remember it because we had a stand outside, but like, I don't think that the administration knew about it. It was just like this weird thing that I remember, and I've been thinking about it a lot, and I'm just like, oh, like that could happen to my son, you know?
So like all 30 kids or whatever, y'all went just outside for some reason, and then nobody said anything?
No, because we were in fourth grade, you know, we were like, this is the teacher, like, this is what she's just...
No, I mean like, an adult didn't say anything?
No, nobody saw. We were, like, in class, and then he was maybe talking or, you know, something, and she was like, everybody get out. And so, like, we all just, like, stood in the hallway, and, like, we just, like, were there waiting for her. But she was just, like, yelling at him, like, in his face and, like, through a desk. Like, it was just wild, but I think at the time, you know, you're a child, so you're just, like, okay. Like, who am I going to go tell? Do you know what I mean? But I've been thinking about that a lot. And so that scares me. And it's also, yeah, like, children, you know, with disabilities that are delayed or that do have autism, and how we treat them. Like, at my son's last school, they had a sensory room because he has sensory issues. And so they would take him to the sensory room. And he asked me, like, if his new school was going to have sensory room. And, like, I was like, Oh, that like breaks my heart because I didn't really know that he knew like this is a sensory room, right? Like, or that he understood that, I should say. And like, I
Yeah.
wish that all schools had a sensory room or that all schools had resources for kids with disabilities or kids with autism, you know, but there's not, we don't even, they don't even have money to buy school supplies. So
That's heartbreaking. That's also community breaking, right? That's also saying like, we don't want to give you resources to take care of your disabled people. It fucks like with community building, culture passing. It just fucks with people because these you're basically splitting people apart because you don't want to give them resources.
yeah, and I mean, I'm lucky. I don't know if lucky is a word, but I know that a lot of parents don't have the resources themselves to figure out what is the best thing for your child. Like a lot, I think, and especially I think with Latinx parents or immigrant parents, like you kind of just want to, you think that whatever the school says or the teachers say is what's best for your child because you trust them. You know, I think that if someone told my mom something about me, she would believe them. Not necessarily because she doesn't believe me, but because she trust. There's like this respect for teachers. I at least I've seen for my family, you know. So yeah. So it is trying to draw like, am I, you know, am I just being resistant to what they're saying because I'm a mom, you know, or
No,
is it real?
it's definitely, yeah, no,
Yeah.
it's definitely real. And this becomes even more so apparent when, like, Latinx kids and, like, immigrant children and a lot of people of color, right, when they enter college and, like, it's just like a whole fucking minefield, right? One of my favorite essays about, like, a Latina student who starts college talks about how, like, she was so lost when she entered college that, as she puts it wasn't that she didn't know how to ask for help is that she didn't even know what questions she should be asking. So it was just like this double like barrier between her and academic success, right? And so it's just one of the many ways in which academia is built against disabled folks, against, people of color, against immigrants, right? And it's not always visible. As a matter of fact, it's been made so invisible that we think the problem is us and not the systems at play.
Yeah, and exactly. My mom was never involved in my education, and it wasn't obviously because she didn't care. You know, she worked, and she also doesn't speak English, which is another thing like that I see a lot like in schools. Like, well, we don't have a good like parents don't care about their kids, or like they don't come out to they're not involved in PTA, or they don't come out to these events. And I'm like, how is it accessible? Like, my mom, and what role would she fit in the PTA if you don't, if she doesn't speak English, right? Or if she's at work all the time? Like, how does she fit into that? So it is a privilege, and it's a lot to navigate. I was also like having some problems that I was like, you know, my boyfriend had suggested like, oh, you should go to like to the school counselor, right, to talk about these things. And it was just like, as a brown single mom, like I can't do that, right? Because then it's like they can easily, everything I say is like they can easily report it to like child protective services, right? Like CPS, even though I'm not endangering my child, to them, you know, they see it's through like a racist classes lens. So like you can't even find those resources in the school, right? Because everything is used against you. So yeah, so it's a lot navigating it, but I mean,
Thinking about like how you mentioned like child protective services are like called on like women of color like for any little thing, right? Someone who I love who is like pregnant was having mood swings, right? And they were really new to her. Right, and she wanted to see a therapist about it. But when she told the nurse that she was doing that, the nurse is also Latina, and she was like, girl, like, if you go to a therapist, like, they're gonna think that you're an unfit parent. And like, and then I like did research, and I was like, oh fuck, like, when pregnant mothers and then like, when new mothers like report like mental health issues due to the pregnancy, right? Because pregnancy fucks with your body, like. A lot of the times they're reported to CPS, right?
yeah, and so it's like you can't even have like an outlet for you want to be better, and it's like you can't do that. So yeah, so I think like these last few weeks have just been like motherhood struggles, but I got a lot of like DMs and comments every time I talk about motherhood on here. So that was just so I'm more conscious of that. But you know, I think like I've also since I've had Chicanismo, since I've been, you know, vocal, I've never really addressed motherhood, and it's more apparent when I get these comments or DMs of like moms that like listen and relate. And so yeah, so I think, I mean, obviously if you're not a parent, you can't really speak too much on it, but I think that it should be like in people's minds, just like how I always talk about like children and advocating for children. It's also about like moms especially, right? And how we don't have any support system whatsoever. So since all this stressful stuff has been going on, I've been like trying to find ways to take my son out or spend time with him, right? Or it's not in like a stressful setting, like at school or when we come home after like a long day and you're tired. So he's like obsessed with the X and Juarez. And it was like I had it on his birthday cake, and he draws it all the time. He's just like obsessed with it. And so I was like, oh, you know, if you do good, I'll take you to the X and Juarez. So I'm supposed to take him today. But I don't know, lately if you've been seeing, there's like articles about how this administration is denying passports to like U.S. born citizens, right? And in border cities, I think Rio Grande Valley was probably hit the most, but also here in El Paso, right? So what's been going on is, and it's not, I don't think it's just this administration, and because it happened to my brother, which I'll talk about, but so basically like if you were delivered by a midwife and that you apply for a passport, then they're trying to find ways to just deny you because they're saying, you know, that you're lying, you weren't born here. Here, for example, in El Paso, there is a midwifery school called Maternidad La Luz. And I don't know if it's the only one in the U.S., but I know a lot of people that come here to go to school here to be a midwife. So there's also a lot of women that come from Juarez to have their baby here, right? My mom was one of them in the 80s. When she was living in Juarez, she crossed to have my brother. And he was delivered by a midwife at a birthing center. So a couple of years ago, my brother, he applied for his passport. And at first, they were, like, trying to deny it. They were saying that he wasn't born here and that he had to prove that he was born here. And it was just this big, drawn-out process where, you know, my brother had to get letters from family members, from, like, people that he went to school with, to whatever he needed to prove that he was born here. And luckily, they accepted the papers that were submitted, and so, you know, he got his passport. But that's basically what they've done. There's a midwife who delivered 900 kids in RGV, and all of those kids, all of a sudden, you know, they're, like, left in this like state of limbo where like they don't know what's going to happen, if they're going to get their passport, if they're, you know what I mean? So that's like a big thing that's been happening. When it happened to my brother, that was not under the Trump administrations. I'm assuming under Obama. So it's not new, but I think that it's just obviously with this administration, everything's kind of talked about more like on like a bigger level. So anyway, so I've been crossing with my son, and like he doesn't have a passport because he's 5. So I'm like, I don't have to apply for one yet. So I just cross and I show his birth certificate. And then yesterday I went to Juarez and I was like, oh, I can't find his like original birth certificate. I'm just going to use a copy that I have. And then I was like, wow, my son was born at home, right? Like I had a home birth, and I was just like, I can't take this because they're going to be like, they could easily be like, nah, like he wasn't, like we don't believe you, or like this is like some forged copy. I don't know, it was stressful. I was just, luckily I found the original one, but even with the original one, I feel like they can easily just say that I forged it, or I don't know.
Yeah, that's a lot. Especially since I assume a lot of folks who might have been home delivered are like targeted for being like Latinx, right? So it's like this double, it's like multiple things, like deciding like who gets to be a citizen, mm-hmm. right? And for me, it had like a lot of parallels to like the Mexican like repatriation act of like the early 1900s. And it was like scary, right? Because it's like, but if you're not familiar with the Mexican repatriation act, and essentially like a lot of people who were even born in the US, they were just like, you know, carted off into trains and sent to Mexico just on the assumption that they were undocumented. And so it's just like a matter of like, even when citizenship is like something that, you know, the nation granted us by virtue of birth, like it still finds way to revoke it regularly. And, you know, for me, it's just like, you know, citizenship shouldn't be a thing. Like, there's no reason why we need this paper to prove that we're alive, right? And that we deserve rights. And also because it's like, ultimately, people of color don't get to be citizens straight up. Right, what, how much time we've been here, like even indigenous folks have been targeted by like border patrol, right? So it's just like, if you're indigenous, if you're black, if you're a person of color, like the state says you don't belong here, right? And finds way to get rid of you. And so all of these things have me thinking about a lot of things that come into that have these connotations of like, you don't get to be a citizen, right? But something else that's happening around this is that like trans people, they're not being given passports, right? And so that to me is just like another sign of like the state deciding like who is afforded humanity, right? Because ultimately, like the citizenship, this paper, you know, it tells the state that you exist, right? And you know, these trans people that are being denied their passports, you know, some of them had already had passports, right? And they were either renewing or, you know, they needed certain things changed, maybe like a gender marker, and they were just like being denied it. And it's just like ridiculous. Because if you know the process of having to apply for identification as a trans person, it's a fucking long and expensive process. Like, I used to do it for people, right? And the minimum cost is like $200. There's fee waivers for these things, but ultimately, like, it ends up costing a lot of money to even, like, consider getting your shit changed, right? Like, you're on your documentation. And so for folks to deny people who already put all this work, right, that they shouldn't be putting in, because nobody should have to prove that they're human, right? Like, it's so ridiculous to me.
Yeah, it is. And it's also, now that you mentioned it, my brother, who I was just talking about, he's trans. And at the time, and now I'm thinking, like, that's just another like barrier that he has to overcome in regards to his passport when he decides to make the change on his passport, right? Or if he even will, because it's just wild.
And this whole thing on like deciding who, you know, who gets to be citizens, right, and who gets afforded humanity, like reminds me of how like, you know, discrimination against trans people and LGBTQ people, like it doesn't just start the moment that they want documentation. It starts as soon as, like, you know, they have not even the, you know, the consciousness to assert themselves as who they are, but as soon as the world perceives them as something. There was this trans child in a school who, you know, had come out for a while now. Everybody knew they were trans. Everybody, like, you know, knew, you know, that they needed to use a specific restroom, right? And so this trans child was made to go to like the nurse's restroom, which is fairly common, right? Or like the office. I work with LGBT kids for a while, and like when a school doesn't have either a gender neutral restroom, or, you know, the consensus around the school isn't that they can use like a binary restroom, usually this child ends up having to go to the, you know, the main office, principal's office, nurse's office to use the restroom. So finally, this child, you know, in this case, didn't want to go all the way to the nurse's restroom. And so they went to the girl's restroom, and somebody, like, I think an adult, like, reported them, and the school shut down for, like, safety reasons, quote unquote, right? Because a child fucking peeing is apparently, like, a safety concern.
Yeah. This was in Oklahoma, by the way, and the student was a seventh grader. But the school shut down for 2 days after the parents threatened the child via Facebook. And how are you going to shut the school down for 7 days instead of doing something about it? Like, in what world is it okay for adults to threaten a child? And you have evidence on Facebook. And that's just disgusting. It's infuriating.
And it's also about like adults dehumanizing like trans kids and saying they don't need care. Like, you know, you're not human to me, so you don't deserve care. You don't deserve to fucking poop and play in peace, right? And so to me, this reminds me of when I was an educator and in one specific case in one school, I was talking to this school who, you know, was getting better at like providing care for trans kids, and they had like 6 gender neutral restrooms. But the problem came when it was time for PE. They still separated the kids according to the sex they were assigned at birth. And so, you know, you had trans boys in all girls classes, right? And like, that fucks at you, right? Or you had little trans girls in all boys classes, right? And that also, like, that fucks with your self-worth, right? You're like, I know I am this, but, and it fucks you, and it gives you dysphoria too. Like, this is how the world sees me. They see me as like this boy, right? When I'm actually a girl, right? And so I kept bringing these issues up with these teachers and these administrators. And one fucking teacher had the gall, the fucking nerve to tell me, like, why doesn't, like, it's like, why do we have to change all these other kids to appease this one trans kid, right? Like, this trans kid should just like learn to deal with it. They should like toughen up, right? And I'm just like, it's funny to me how it's easier to tell trans kids who are already marginalized to toughen up, as if existing as a trans person wasn't hard enough already and like doesn't already make you tough as shit a lot of the times. But like, it's so much to ask of tolerance from other children. And so that really fucked with me. And so I burst out at them with something like that. And they just shut up. And they realize their mistake, right? But it still fucks with me how common this thought is, right? Of how, like, the, like, LGBT kids should have to, like, learn how to navigate. It's not the world that should learn how to be kind.
Yeah, and for example, I actually just pulled up an article that the kid's name, her name is Maddie. She's 12 years old. Her name is Maddie. And I just pulled it up because her mom, Brandy, she set up a GoFundMe so that she can move out of this town to Houston. And that's just another, like, ugly reality for a lot of parents, too, that instead of, like, the school or, like, the police, even though as much as we hate the fucking cops and they don't do shit, they're supposed to, but they don't, like, you have to move your entire family to another city. That, I mean, it might happen in Houston, right? It can happen anywhere. But of course, this is like a small town in Oklahoma. So, like, you have to do whatever is safest for your child. And for her, it's moving to a bigger city. And that's just like, what if, like, she doesn't even have money to move, but she knows that she has to for her child safety, you know? But we shouldn't, yeah. Parents shouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, it's infuriating because a lot of this is on the parents, right? A lot of this bigot, like, kids aren't fucking born bigots. Like, they really fucking aren't, mm-mm, right? A lot of this is learned, and because it is learned, it can also be unlearned, mm-hmm, right?
Or even it unlearned also in a school setting, right? Because you can have, mm-hmm, your parents that, I think, yes, your parents have a big influence on you. I know that growing up, my parents did, right? But also in school, if the teachers and the administration are teaching you something else, you can also have that gateway to be like, oh, maybe my parent is wrong, right? So it's like, I think that schools are also responsible for these things. They should be held accountable.
Absolutely. And it's got me thinking about Jemele Miles, right? Who is somebody that really hit close to home, right? You know, they were really young. I believe they were 7. And they committed suicide because they were bullied at school for being gay, right? This child was only 9, and they came out to their parents, and their parents accepted them, and they were really happy about that, and they were really happy about who they were. Then they went to school, and the kids bully him, essentially to death, right? The child went back home and committed suicide. And that's not something that is normal. Not in that... I'm saying it's not normal because it's like, cishet kids don't really have to worry about this. And so when the news of this child committing suicide came out, some folks were like, how does this child even know about suicide? And I'm just like, you know, when I found out about queerness, I almost, you know, immediately also found out about suicide. These things were hand in hand for me, not only because of media representation, because, you know, especially in the 90s when I was, you know, coming into, you know, my teenage years, like every queer trans character that existed, it was like a sad storyline, like they were bound to die, right? So for me and a lot of people like me, queerness and transness equated death, right? And so when the media sends these messages, when society sends you these messages that you are not wanted in this world, you take those to heart and you act on those, right? Despite what the people closest to you say, right? And so that really hit home, because it also reminded me again of like how when I would teach, I would also teach psychiatrists, psychologists, and doctors about like, this is how you treat LGBT youth and blah, blah, blah. And often specifically psychologists and psychiatrists would often be like, what trauma caused LGBT kids to be LGBT? And I'm like, often no trauma. LGBT kids aren't just LGBT, right? And that needs to be respected. And instead of asking about like what made LGBT kids who they are, like ask them why society persecutes them. Ask society why they persecute LGBT kids for existing, right? Ask society why they choose to traumatize LGBT folks, specifically LGBT youth, and specifically those of color. And a lot of times they shut up, right? Because a lot of times people, when you ask these questions, they realize the bigotry that is loaded into these questions, right? Of like why queer people are traumatized.
Yeah, and I see that narrative a lot, that they must have been abused, or they must have, something must have happened for you to be gay or queer, right? And I also did see that question a lot on Twitter in relation to Jamal Miles about how do you know, or not just in relation to him, but I see it all the time in relation to like queer youth, where they're like, how do they even know they're gay? And I'm like, how do you know you're straight, right? You're straight when you're in fifth grade, you say you are. So how do you know that if you've never kissed somebody? So it's really just like, just come out and say you're homophobic or transphobic or a bigot, instead of trying to jump hoops, trying to, you know, sound smart when you're not. But yeah, it's another ugly thing. It's disabled children, and now we're talking about like LGBTQ children and how their children are very unprotected, and usually the violence that they meet is at the hands of adults, not other children. Yes, there are other children who are bullies, but where does that, you know, where does that narrative even come from? From adults, from society?
Yeah, absolutely. And so a lot of this like abuse and harassment and bigotry towards, you know, LGBT kids doesn't end there, right? And a lot of times this abuse and this harassment and this hatred is like unseen, right? Because it's so normalized, right? Because we dehumanize queer and trans people, we don't see their suffering. And so that reminds me of Emma Sokolowicz, who you might know as Mattress Girl. They came into the national spotlight when they started a performance art project where they carried their mattress throughout their lives, right? After they were raped and the school dismissed their case against their rapist. And so they appeared, I think, in the cover of Time magazine and multiple other articles, right? And they all called them Mattress Girl. But the thing about that is that, like, they're not a girl. They identify as non-binary, right? And they use they, them pronouns. So it's like how a lot of our narratives of survival don't fit in very neatly into this, like, cis-hetero model of, like, survivors, right, and victims and sexual abuse, right, the perpetrator actually had harassed trans femme before Emma, and when this trans femme came out against their rapist, the rapist was like, there's no way I sexually harassed them because I'm not gay, right? That's a dude. And so it brings to light how this rapist brought up queerness as a way of, like, as a nasty thing that would make them a rapist, right? And in their assault of Emma, it also brings up how, like, they didn't, you know, rape a girl, they raped a non-binary person, and what all that it entails, right? Not only for Emma's pain, but also I think of how, like, we often in LGBT communities, we don't speak of abuse and survival because we're not taught to do that, right? We're not taught, like, this is how harassment looks outside of a cis hetero woman and a cis hetero male, right? And this is how you speak up. Or when we do have those tools, we might also be told that, like, you don't want to put an LGBT person in danger, right, by outing them as an abuser. And so there's a lot of things working here that really silenced Emma, right?
Yeah, and I saw that you shared that article, and I thought it was so important, especially because they were in the mainstream. Like, this was before the Me Too movement, right? So it was just on their own. Carrying the mattress was so powerful. Like, it was a really big thing. And so for now, what is, like, a year later, for this article to come out stating that they are non-binary and what that entails and what they went through because of it, like, I think that is really important. And I think you were the only person I saw that shared the article. So I hope that, you know, that this is given just as much light as when they came out with their story. And I think that, speaking of the Me Too movement, right, because I think the Me Too movement is centered, I think, mostly on women. I know that there have been male survivors that have spoken up, but I think it's centered mostly on women. And so we need to have more. And I'm not saying, like, every survivor needs to share their story, especially if you're LGBTQ, right? Like, that's never something that I would push, right? That's, survivors will share their story if they want to. But I do think that if there are LGBTQ folks, if there's men that share their stories, we should also highlight them as much as we highlight women survivors.
Yeah. And for me, it's not like Tarana Burke's Me Too movement is the one that left out LGBT folks, because she's been really intentional about censoring the most marginalized. It's been like the neoliberal co-option of the movement.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
Which then prioritized, you know, cis, heterosexual white women at the expense of everybody else. And not that, you know, their stories weren't important, but they weren't the only ones that needed to be highlighted. And so what needs to happen now is that in these discussions of survivor, people really need to understand different paradigms of survivor and abuser that don't center cis-hetero relations. And a part of that is listening to when LGBT folks speak up.
Yes, very simple thing to do, very important. And speaking of the Me Too movement, recently two of the abusers that were called out, it's been like a year, Louis C.K. and Aziz Ansari, have reappeared on the comedy scene. Louis C.K. randomly showed up to, like, Mike Knight, whatever you call it. I don't know where it was. I'm sorry. I should have had this information, but you can look it up if you want, like, the actual details. But he showed up unannounced, and the owner of the club let him, you know, do his thing. And apparently he got a standing ovation, of course. Aziz Ansari has done, like, two shows secretly. Pretty much just, like, came back, like, trying to just come back into the spotlight very discreetly. Right. And it hasn't even been a year. And I know, because we talked about Aziz Ansari a lot in one of our episodes. And, like, we just mentioned, we've only been recording for a year. So it hasn't even been a full year. And Aziz Ansari's whack ass is already like, OK, I did my time. And I could have sworn he didn't even make a statement Ruben says he did, and I'll look it up, but I swear he didn't even fake apologize. Like, he just, I think he didn't even say shit. But anyway, the point is, this conversation of, like, that we, I know me and Ruben always talk, like, about justice for survivors and what does that look like, and, you know, do rapists and abusers, do they, quote-unquote, change? How do we allow them back into society? How do we hold them accountable, right? And for me, like, personally, obviously, Losi, Kane, Aziz, Ansari have not been held accountable. They have not lost anything. They just, Louis C.K. said some fake apology. Aziz Ansari, I don't even think he said one. And then they just disappeared for a couple months. And then they just come back. Like, everything's cool. And everyone welcomes them back with open arms, right? So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more, obviously, a lot of more abusers and rapists who just, like, randomly want to stroll back, and we all know that they're going to be forgiven and welcomed back with open arms because we don't care about survivors ultimately.
And that's really infuriating, because it's like, and people were like, oh, they did their time and blah blah blah, and it's like, no, they didn't do shit. Like, y'all just, like, think that a call out is accountability, when it's just like telling you that they did something wrong,
or a big apology. Like, all they have to do is, like, oh, I did this, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, as if that fixes anything, right? And so, Yenny Yang, this Asian comedian, she was, like, I think the most vocal about this, because, you know, she's had to navigate the comedian world, right, as, like, a woman of color. And she's like, you know, there's some tangible things that you can actually try to do to make up for these things, right? And these include things like making up the money that the people you abused, like, lost, right? Because people forget that it costs upwards of $100,000, you know, to survive rape. And people don't like to think about money, right? But recently, as, you know, somebody did the report on, like, what therapists cost, what hospitals cost, what time off from work costs, what's, you know, and this is not just, like, a trauma that you get over, you know, in a week or a month or a year. This is a long-lasting trauma that affects your abilities forever. And so that has an effect on how you can survive and your, you know, your finances. And so if, you know, these people wanted to do something, they could, you know, fucking give money. They can give their platform up. They can give to organizations that support survivors. They can ensure that they never do this again and never abuse their power by giving up that power, right? Celebrity is ultimately power, right? And it put in whether they and how people with this power wield it is important. And if you have been known to mismanage it, a good way to begin the healing process is to give it up and to do something else where you're in the background making up for your fucking abuses. And so, to me, this whole thing was also a bunch of people who were not Louis C.K. or Aziz Ansari's victims accepting an apology, right? That wasn't theirs to accept, right? Meanwhile, you know, the people that they've abused haven't, you know, for all we know, recovered, not only physically, emotionally, mentally, but financially. So what does it mean when we want to continue to give these abusive men power and resources, but not survivors? Why are we so quick to bring up things like, you know, cancel culture and, like, the prison industrial complex as a way not to bring up new ways of accountability and new ways of healing, but instead new ways to excuse abuse, right? And that's because people aren't invested in finding new ways of healing, right? And of being there for survivors. And, like, all this, like, derailment that brings up the prison industrial complex as, like, a way, like, you know, people are like, oh, you don't believe in incarceration, so why should we persecute abusers? There must be another way, right? I don't know why people are so in a hurry to protect abusers, but not in a hurry to protect survivors. And even more specifically, how these discussions of abolition don't happen in a way that talk about how the prison system and the police force itself actually abuses people, right? And is a vessel for rape, right?
And it also re-victimizes survivors for defending themselves, for surviving in ways that they need to, right? A lot of survivors are sex workers. Sex workers end up in prison. Women who have stood up to their abusers, I know, like the whole stand your ground, whatever law in Florida is a big thing. There's a lot of women who go to prison for defending themselves. There's a lot of survivors in prison who are trying to heal, and then they go to a place where that violence and that trauma just exist even more in a more violent way. When we talk about like the prison industrial complex, and it's not just capitalism, it's not just, you know, racism, it's everything that entails.
Yeah, because if we like really wanted to be about it, we would be having more conversations, we would have more actions about attacking the prison industrial complex when it fucks people over that society thinks are undeserving of protection, right? Like sex workers, right? Who face some of the highest amount of violence, right? Specifically, and when we talk about sex workers, we have to pay attention to how sex workers do this by choice, right? A part of that choice is acknowledging that sometimes people's choices are limited. Specifically when we talk about like marginalized people, right? Even more so when we talk about trans people, right? So trans people can be discriminated against getting a job in like more than half of the United States, right? So what does that mean for employment? What options does that give people, right? And it gives them very few. And so this is why we see a lot of trans people turn to sex work as a mode for survival, right? So yes, they choose it, but also their choices are limited. And if people were really invested in like making sure that everybody who did sex work did it because that's, you know, their life goal, then they would be paying attention to these systems of oppression that lead people to make these choices, right? And put them in danger, right? Recently, Donna G. Castleberry was murdered by a undercover policeman, Andrew Mitchell. Andrew Mitchell tried to drag Donna G. Castleberry into his car that was unmarked, right? Because he was supposedly undercover and trying to get Donald G. Castleberry into jail for outstanding warrants for soliciting sex, right? So essentially, he was trying to prove that she was a sex worker after she'd already been charged with being a sex worker, right? And trying to get her in jail for that. And so she didn't know who that was, right? That wasn't a police officer. That was a strange man. So imagine being dragged into a strange car by a strange man, right? You're gonna fucking fight or flight. And so she stabbed him in his hand, and in response, he shot her at least 8 times, and she died, right? And so very few people are talking about this. It's upsetting because we don't think about sex workers when we talk about not only abolition, but also about abuse and the ways in which this cop was legally allowed to rape her, right? It is legal in at least 35 states in the US for cops to have sex with sex workers if they're undercover, right? And if you're concealing a part of your identity, intentions, if you're concealing those type of like really fucked up reasons why you're having sex with somebody, right? You want to imprison them. That is rape, straight up, right? And so these things, I think, need to be talked about, and I think they need to be understood within a survivor advocate and abolitionist framework.
Yeah, which brings me on the subject of the, right now there's an ongoing national prison strike. It started August 21st and it'll end September 9th. I've seen people post about the prison strike. I wish there was more on it. Some of the demands of the men and women of the prisons, and I'm reading it from the website, is immediate improvements to the conditions of prisons and prison policies that recognize the humanity of imprisoned men and women. I think that's like the main, right? That we should treat prisoners with dignity and respect as humans. We just talked about the abuse that happens in prisons. We prison is an ugly place. And when I post about, you know, in solidarity with prisoners, a lot of people are like, why? They should have thought about that before they ended up there. Or, you know, that's the time that they're doing, when a lot of people fail to acknowledge that a lot of the people in prison are not there for violent crimes. They are there because of the prison industrial complex that targets Black and brown, not just men, but women, a lot of trans people as well, right? A lot of poor people, disabled people, people that have to commit, I don't want to say commit crimes, because a lot, when we look at what are crimes, right, it's a whole conversation of bullshit, but they do things out of because of poverty, or there's like the school to prison pipeline, the foster care. A lot of foster kids end up in prison because they don't have a support system. So it's not like this black and white thing, right, that I think a lot of privileged people see, like, oh, well, they were in jail, so they must be in there for a good reason. When a lot, the majority of people in prison did absolutely nothing that warrants them to be there. But regardless, they should all be treated with respect, right? Like, there, I've posted articles about how there was one prison in Texas last year who had no AC. In Texas, like, that shit is awful. Just a lot of conditions that they have to face, whether that's having to not to ex- to be like, whether that's being paid shit money or absolutely nothing, right, for their labor, which is a, like, slavery. Which, like, last year, for example, I had posted this story of, I don't know what city it was in Texas, but they didn't have AC. Like, just a very simple thing like that, where the summers in Texas are fucking hot. So imagine being in a cell and you can't breathe. There's no air condition. Pregnant women in prison sometimes have to deliver their babies in shackles. There's a lot of abuse at the hands of, like, prison guards, for example. That there's been cases in California of, like, poor women and women of color being sterilized without their consent. There's just so many things that go on in prisons that people tend to overlook, right? Because we don't think about it. We don't see people in prison as humans, and that's intentional. Prisons are most of the time away in some place where you cannot, there's like no human contact. And prison, again, is not rehabilitation. It's not. It should be, but it's not. For example, my brother is in prison right now, and he got sent somewhere in Dallas. And Dallas is like 12 hours away driving. So how, you know, he doesn't see his family. There's no way for him to have contact with us. I think even talking on the phone is this big thing, because prisons charge you, like, just so much money to even talk to people in prison. And I believe last week, actually, I had shared an article about the Texas prison system that slashed the phone calls by 77%. And that is a big deal, because I know, for example, for me, I haven't been able to talk to my brother because he's like, I don't have money. Like, I don't have money to make those phone calls. So that's a big win. And it's just simple things like that. Like, how are, there's this quote by Angela Davis, and I can't think of it right now, but it's like, prisons don't rehabilitate. They're made to disappear people. And that's exactly what prisons do, to have no contact with other people. And how are they going to rehabilitate and be better? Not to mention that when they get out, they end up right back into that system because there's no support on the outside. They can't get jobs. They have a hard time getting on their feet. So it's just like a cycle that no one talks about.
Yeah, and that's one critique that people had about, like, you know, there was a few people who would share about, like, the prison strike, but they focused just on, like, labor, right? Which is important, right? Because, you know, the prison system is a modern slavery system, just straight up. We have people working as firefighters, right, getting paid as little as 37 cents an hour for fucking fighting forest fires, right? And then after they come out of jail, they can't get hired as firefighters, even though they have firefighter experience in, like, the most extreme cases, right? And so it's about, how do we exploit these people, but also make them so that they're, like, untouchable, right? They're not, they're, or undesirable, Like, they're people we don't want to see. And this is another demand from the prison strike, is that they reestablish Pell Grants, which, if you don't know, a Pell Grant is like a federal grant that allows a lot of people to go to college, right? And so if you have certain felonies, right, and most of them nonviolent, a lot of them have to do with like marijuana and like drugs, not in nonviolent, like drug crimes. And so if people have this type of felony, they all of a sudden can't go to college. And so, like, not only do you put people in this cage, not only do you make people, you know, into slaves, but then when they serve their time, quote unquote, like their time, because who decides that, right? But a system that is built to attack poor people, to attack poor people of color, right? When they survive their time and they want to, you know, re-enter the world, right? What options do they have? They can't go to school. A lot of places won't hire them because of their record. So how does one re-enter society after prison says we are undeserving of existing with other people? And so I think about that. I also think about how, like, a lot of people that go to prisons, they go on plea deals, right? On forced plea deals, right? Because they accept automatically the guilty trial because they can't afford a lawyer. So a lot of times it's a public defender that defends them. And the public defender, you know, if you don't know what that is, it's somebody who's your lawyer, but it's for free. And it's like state assigned, right? A public defender is state assigned. And they're overworked with cases. And so a lot of the times, to make sure that they get through the workload, is that like, hey, it's easier if we take a plea deal. That means that you're going to have to plead guilty and you're going to have to make this, you know, you're going to have to serve like 2 years, instead of like having to fight for your innocence, and you risk the chance of like, you know, 10, 15 years or more, right? And so a lot of times a sure 2 years sounds more agreeable than the possibility of 10 plus years in prison. And this specifically to poor people, right, isn't even of choice, right? Like I brought up earlier when talking about sex workers, sometimes we say people make choices, but oftentimes we have to look at like how many choices do people have, right? If you're fucking broke, like if you're not only broke and poor are not the same thing. If you're poor and you can't feed your child, right, and no matter working 80 hours, how many fucking hours you work, right, how, and you can't feed your child, what the fuck are you gonna do? Your choices are let your child starve, right? Or, you know, fill in the gaps where like other help, even public help, right, WIC or whatever, won't cover, right? And you go about doing illegal things, right? And so when we talk about these prisoners decided to make these choices, we have to look at what choices that they have, what resources that they have, so that they didn't make these choices. And oftentimes they didn't have very many resources and thus didn't have very many choices, right? And so I really need people to like look beyond labor, right? That's important. And it's so important that it was like, the first and second demands, I think, of the prison strike. But with that also came, right, the demand that people get, you know, just trials, right? Fair trials, the end to immediate racial overcharging and over sentencing and parole denials of black and brown humans. It also states black humans shall no longer be denied parole because the victim of the crime was white, which is a particular problem in the southern states, right? So we have to look at patterns of criminalization and how, like, you know, racially, you know, black people are targeted the most, and even more so when like the people who accuse them of things are white, right? So all these things need to be taken into consideration, not just the things that sound like fine and dandy to us. We have to confront the hard truths about the prison industrial complex, right? So that's just some things. And
there's like I said a lot more that we should be talking about and focusing on rather than just the wage labor. But I did, you know, I keep thinking like, wow, I mentioned my brother like three times in this podcast, and My brother, he is trans, and so he's in prison right now. And so that I wanted to highlight that that's also another thing, right? For trans people that are in prison, like that they're sent to prisons that aren't their gender. And I know that was a big thing for my brother. They put my brother in like solitary because they didn't know where to place him, and because they said that the other inmates felt uncomfortable. And that's just focusing on just navigating it as a trans person, right? And when I think about my brother, I also think what, you know, we're talking about sex workers and surviving, or not just sex workers, but a lot of people that end up in prison do it out of survival, right? They do these things because they need to survive. And for my brother, a lot of it was him needing money for transition, right? For a therapy. So because there's no resources for trans people, they end up in these places where they also are more prone to violence because they are trans. So, I mean, that was enlisted on like the list of demands, but of course not everything was listed on there. But I did also want to highlight, and not just for trans folks in prison, but also just queer people. They're more subject to abuse in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's hella important. Even in the most well-meaning spaces, right, trans prisoners are ignored, right? And that's one of the gaps that the organization Black and Pink, which Miss Major is involved in, right? If you don't know Miss Major, she was one of the original badass bitches from the Stonewall Movement. She has been in prison before, knows what it's like to exist in prison as a Black trans woman, right? And her whole life work is about prison abolition as it pertains to LGBT folks, specifically those of color, right? And, you know, I've had very many people in and out of the prison industrial complex, and it's been, you know, difficult to see a lot of folks come out and, you know, have to go back in because they didn't gain any skills while in prison. They didn't learn how to not, you know, in the case of the person closest to me that was in prison, right? They didn't learn how to not sell drugs, essentially, right? That was their only, like, venue to making money for a minute. And then when they came out and they were labeled an ex-convict and they couldn't get another job, right? Like, so what jobs are available to you? How do you survive after, you know, being labeled a convict? And you just go back to old patterns, right? And so it was heartbreaking to see that happen multiple times to the people that I love the most. I think a lot of the times, because humanity is built on this model of disposability, we would rather do away with people who we think like did something wrong, right? Subjectively, not objectively wrong, like subjectively wrong. Like, we would rather disappear them than deal with them. And so I think back to Angela Davis, right? She talks about how, like, in her book, like, you know, are prisons obsolete? She talks about how, like, prisons exist because we can't imagine a world without them. And so in order for that to happen, we have to begin having these difficult conversations about what a world without prisons and without policing can be, right? A lot of people are like, oh, well, who are you going to call when you're in danger? And I'm just like, if we had more like community response teams, right, we wouldn't need to be fucking calling the cops for everything. We wouldn't need to be putting people in danger, right? Specifically in a world where calling the cops on, like, a person of color, specifically if they're Black, it almost certainly means death.
Yeah, and so, again, we need to keep talking about this, not just, I mentioned that the prison strike is technically over, but it's not just during a prison strike. It's all the time. It should be, if we care about social justice, feminism, LGBTQ issues, poverty, capitalism, any of those things, we need to care about the prison industrial complex in full, not just in one aspect. But speaking of, it was really silent. The Democrats were really silent in regards to the prison strike, I noticed. I didn't really see much commentary from them, which is not surprising, but also, they did have a lot to say about John McCain, so.
Yeah, no, and it's because, like, Of course, liberals didn't acknowledge the prison strike because a lot of them like take prison money, right? You know, Hillary Clinton during her campaign, it was revealed that she had essentially slaves working for her house, right? So she had
prisoners. Yes.
Yeah, she had prisoners working at her home essentially for free, right? They were doing the housekeeping and the lawn work for her, right? Kamala Harris, right? The most recent like liberal superhero. I fucking hate her. She was a fucking district attorney, which is like super cop essentially, right? Her job was to send people to prison. Even though she had this language of like, you know, the prison complex like attacks people of color, she still actively was an agent towards that imprisonment, right? And even more so, she specifically attacked trans people and sex workers, right? There was a case where a trans woman in prison fought for gender reassignment surgery and she had won it, but Kamala Harris and her team denied it to her, right? And then there was Kamala Harris' entire fucking campaign against Backpage, which was like the website that helps sex workers screen potential clients, right? And her whole thing was that supposedly it made it easier for traffickers, right, to put people on the market, but they completely ignored the fact that, like, there's an entire fucking dark web where traffickers already do that. As a matter of fact, a lot of trafficking agencies claim that the removal of Backpage has only made their work harder because now they cannot identify a person being trafficked online as easily, right? So before they had missing database and you could match it to the people who were, you know, promoting services on Backpage. And if those two things matched, you can be like, hey, this person's being trafficked. We gotta go help them. Now that's no longer available. And so a lot of these liberals are indicted in the prison industrial complex. And so they really haven't spoken up about it. And the dissonance in that is that it's not uncomfortable for them to praise a war criminal like John McCain, who also, like, worked his ass off to fucking ensure that disabled people didn't have access to healthcare.
It was, like, his dying wish, so, apparently.
Yeah, like, he he literally rose from the fucking dead.
To say that. To deny people healthcare.
He was a fucking zombie and just like, oh, you know what? Fuck disabled people before I leave. Somebody made the joke about, like, because he, like, chose to not continue his
treatment, right?
His treatment, right? So some people are like, oh, he died doing what he loved, denying, you know, sick people health.
I posted about John McCain and I was like, laugh out loud, like, whatever, he's a piece of shit. And I had all these people, like, it was, you know, people just act real silly whenever a piece of shit person dies. Like, they lose all common sense. Like, they're just like, like in life, they're just like, fuck John McCain. But then he dies and everyone's like, oh my God, stop. Please respect him. Oh my God, he was like a hero, kind of. He stood up to Trump somehow. I just saw so many ridiculous things.
Yeah, when in reality, he voted with Trump 83% of the fucking time. So, like, what?
It's just,
are they even talking about?
It's just, I don't even know what it is. And I want to say it's respect. I don't even know it's respectability. I really don't know what it is. But I just like, what are you all going to say when fucking Trump dies? I can already see it. You're all going to be like, stop, respect him. He just died. He didn't mean it. You know, like that was during his time. He thought that building a wall was like the right thing to do. And then the whole, what was it? Was it during John McCain's funeral? And there's like this picture of like George Bush and Michelle Obama sharing candy. And then everyone was like, oh, George Bush, so cute. I love him. His relationship, his friendship with Michelle Obama. And I'm just like, what? George, are we talking about the same dad, George Bush? Like, what the fuck is wrong with liberals? I don't. And I can't even say that because you know what? I posted about about everyone's favorite liberal or recent favorite liberal recently, which we talked about on our last. Oh,
Alexandria.
Yeah. So I posted about her, how she sent her condolences to John McCain. And then I posted the tweets that me and you talked about on our last episode about how she was like, kind of like, it does not mean abolish deportation. We have to replace ICE, like those key words. Right. And I lost like a lot of followers, surprisingly. I don't know why I was surprised, but I was. I was like, wow, people are like really mad about this. I don't know. Liberals, we have this conversation all the time, but
And then we have to keep having it, right? Because it's like a process of like unlearning liberalism, right?
Yes.
So with Alexandria Cortez, Cortez, right? It comes down to essentially the system, right? Using a friendly face to pass their shit, right? So it's like, oh, look at this, like, you know, New York, like Afro-Latina, right? She like talks like you. But at the end of the day, yeah, she talks like me, but she's just talking my slang so she can subjugate, like, Palestinians and, like, maintain ICE.
I know.
Right?
People were like,
and
people were like, you took that tweet out of context. I'm like, no, she said what she said. Like, I just, I didn't even, you know, when I get posts like that, I reply to some people and then I just stop because I'm like, I'm not going to repeat the same thing over and over. But,
And to me, it was kind of like a sign of like how a lot of these people like don't fucking do the work at home of like calling their own out, right? Because they see like, oh, somebody looks like me and they're apparently on the good side, so that must be enough. And it's like, no, these people are saying fucked up things. You should confront that. And if you can't confront this on a fucking like passive, like impersonal scale, I sure as hell know you ain't doing that shit at home, right? When your mama says something anti-black, you know, when your Jewish household says something Zionist, right? When citizen as like household says something xenophobic against undocumented people. All these things, like, we talk about them because they show how like you people act at home, essentially, right? And so I think that's important to talk about. It's important to understand that, like, you know, Alexandra, we don't gotta, personally, there's no problem with her. It's a problem with, like, what agenda she's pushing. And a part of that is, like, making this war criminal John McCain seem like fucking, like, something we should accept, right? When in reality, like, this motherfucker fought at Vietnam. And he was, like, a proud, like, agent of that war, right? And it's, like, we have unanimously as, like, a country, right? Like, I thought we had all agreed that Vietnam was an unjust war. There was a shit ton of protests during this time for a reason. And, you know, he called, you know, Asian peoples, you know, a slur that begins with G and said he would never apologize for that. You know, he, when talking about the Iraqi war, right, which we also protested was because it was also an unjust war brought on by a fucking warmonger and part of a warmonger family, the Bush administration, right? When asked about that, he said, bomb, 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 bomb Iraq, right? Like, singing like bomb Iraq to the tune of fucking Beach Boy song. Like, how much more baby boomer bigoted pieces of shit can you be, right? And so people defending John McCain and like talking about, oh, we have to be nice to the dead, I'm like, no, we don't have to be nice to the dead, especially not when they're fucking murderers. Like, I can't imagine, like, when the whole George Bush passing candy to Michelle Obama shit happened, I was, and everybody was gushing over it. I'm just like, y'all bitches are gonna eulogize this dude the same way y'all eulogized John McCain and forget about all of the fucking, like, the war in Iraq and how the Patriot Act was because of him and how all this fucking Islamophobia that has been on the rise, like, globally, like, was a part of his narrative. Like, we're going to forget about that. I don't even want to think about what the fuck they're going to say about Donald Trump when he fucking croaks. They're going to be like, I didn't always agree with him, but... and some stupid shit.
I gotta go. I don't know. And it's like, we all have to undo things. I think that a lot of people, especially if you're coming into, like, politics or, like, new politics, like, you are going to be defensive about it because you're like, well, I believe in these people. Like, these... or you identify as a Democrat, right? Because you, for whatever reason, I think that's not the problem. Like, I'm sure I identified as, like, a Democrat or a liberal at one point in my life, you know? But it's, like, the reaching and, like, the people, like, that attack me for saying things. Like, I don't know. That's, like, what bothers me. It's not necessarily that people, like, believe in these people or that people are saying they're Democrats. It's like your actions and what you think and how you react to people saying that the people that you believe in are shit or that You know what? Like, for example, if you're going to vote for Robert O'Rourke, you know what? Go fucking do it. Like, do it. But understand that he's not, like, this perfect white savior, right? Like, understand that if he wins against Ted Cruz, that it's not just like, oh, okay, everything's great in Texas now. No, he has really problematic views. And, like, people highlighting those views is not, like, this bad thing. It's like actually a very good thing, a very important thing, because then we'll be able to try, we'll at least try to hold him accountable, right? So that's like where the problem lies. It's not, you know, I'm not trying to say like, oh, everyone's so like ridiculous if you call yourself a liberal, because, you know, maybe you haven't read up on other things, maybe you haven't been exposed to like other, you know what I mean, like other political views. Like that's not the problem. The problem is like actually trying to take in the critiques of liberalism. But we've been talking for like a long time about a lot of important things. And I think I wanted to wrap up this episode on a much lighter note.
In conclusion, fuck John McCain and fuck anyone that sent his their condolences out to this warmonger, which includes a bunch of like celebrities like fucking Karamo from Queer Eye, who like I have a bone to pick. Like after watching the first season, like not even the first four episodes of Queer Eye, Karamo's just like DeRay in the making, where he's like really pushing like these liberal politics. So he posted like a clip of someone coming to John McCain with, oh, Obama's an Arab, and then John McCain was like, no, he's not an Arab, he's a good man. And it's like, why do you think that's a good thing to post? Like, you're just saying that like Arab people are not good people.
I saw that actually. I saw a lot of people use that as a reference, that like John McCain was a good person, like standing up to racism while being racist.
Like, I'm like, okay, so you hate Arab people, but you like Obama.
I'm telling you, though, people are so ridiculous when people die. It's so embarrassing. I want people to tell people that I'm a bitch. Don't be lying. Don't be lying on me.
Same. I want to be remembered accurately. Like,
I will be there to tell your real story, Ruben.
Thanks. You're going to be like, he oppressed me while shooting bitter brown femmes.
God, that's so ugly. I was not allowed to have thoughts of my own during the recordings of Bitter Brown Femmes.
He would give me a script and I would have to follow that script.
But he was a good guy.
Yeah.
He meant well.
Yeah. So I was like, we were trying to find like an artist that was like, fuck John McCain, right? But like, there really wasn't any, right?
We had like, a hard time choosing a song because all the artists just suck. There was not one artist that was like, fuck John McCain.
I mean, there was a while ago, but Cassandra Hates Women.
Oh my God. Oh, ABBA.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, I'm the misogynist here, apparently.
TBH, wow. This is what feminism is about. but ABBA in 2008, when John McCain was using their song Take a Chance on Me for like his campaign trail for some godforsaken reason, like, why is that the song that you choose?
Because anyway, he wanted people to take a chance on him.
Yeah, and Sarah Palin, which like there's a big conversation to be had about like the normalization of like the ridiculous conservative, right? Because like, do you remember what a shit show Sarah Palin was?
Yeah, he's to blame. He's the reason we know Sarah Palin exists, and just that alone is like no condolences for you.
TBH, in case you don't know who Sarah Palin is, she was once in the running towards becoming America's next top vice president, and she could see Russia from Alaska.
Oh my gosh, she was so fucking ridiculous. It was like almost like she was a joke, but it wasn't a joke.
Yeah, so John McCain decided that we should take a chance on them, and ABBA was like, nah, stop using my shit, like, cease and desist. And I wanted to play them also because I've, you know, been very taken by the cultural phenomenon that is Mamma Mia, which Cassandra refuses to engage. Because, oh, again, the internalized misogyny just, like, jumps out.
But instead, and then we decided we wanted to play Anti-Flag, but then, like, they're just...
That's kind of like white boy angry, too white boy angry for the podcast. But I did go through a big Anti-Flag phase when I was like in eighth grade, and I was like, fuck the government, yeah, anarchy. But I was listening to Anti-Flag, so it wasn't that radical. But at the time, I thought it was. And the song we were going to play is called Your Daddy Was a Rich Man, Your Daddy's Fucking Dead, which was really appropriate, and you should check it out on your own. And one time I was yelling it out my window, and my mom made me give her the CD so she can break it because my neighbors complained. So, yeah, total punk rock story.
Yeah, I came into them because I knew a cover band when I lived in Ventura. Their name was Black Fag, and it was a queer...
that's cute.
Yeah, queer band, and they would, like, redo anti-flag songs, like, from a queer, like, black perspective. But, like, I never really was really like, oh, yeah, anti-flag, like, they're, like, the voice of radicalness, right? I think the closest I got to that was, like, Rage Against the Machine. Like, I was into them when they were...
At least, like, Rage is, like... Is the singer is Latino, no?
Yeah, and he's hot as fuck.
But, like, Anti-Flag is just, like, all white guys. You know what I mean? I wonder what... I'm going to look up Anti-Flag. I haven't listened to Anti-Flag or followed them, obviously, in, like, years. But I did think about them, like, a while ago, because I was like, oh, I wonder... Oh, no, actually, they came to El Paso, like, a year ago. And I remember... Actually, I went to go get... When I was doing the petition for Duranguito. And I was like, yeah, all the, you know, all the radical punk people are totally going to sign this. And they were like, nah, I'm here at this Anti-Flag... show, but also I love gentrification. Fucking posers, you know? But I haven't followed, like, their new music, or, like, I guess, like, when I listened to them, I wasn't really aware of a lot of things, like racism and, like, fully, you know, fully understood what I know now. So I'm like, oh, I wonder if, like, they, like, where they stand on, like, Black Lives Matter, or, like, on this, or, like, on that, that I'm, like, that invested in them, but it just crossed my mind. You know?
Yeah.
But anyway.
Anyway, so their lyrics are always like, eh. I was like, yeah, this message is dope. And then I was like, why do they use this other fucked up, like, language? Anyway, Cassandra gave me the privilege to choose this song that has nothing to do with the episode. So I'm going to play Mitski for y'all, because that's all I've been listening to for, like, the last week. Because there's no way I barely got Mitski through her. Like, she was not about to let me play Casey Musgraves. So, so we're going to play Mitski's Washing Machine Heart from her new album, Be the Cowboy. Mitski is a Japanese-American artist. Her sound is, like, kind of sad, but, like, also kind of rock and roll. Her other big song, like, big for an indie artist, was Your Best American Girl, which is about, like... her, like, realizing that she really can't fuck with white boys because, like, the cultural differences are too vast. So, yeah, so check her out. I hope you like this song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Shut the fuck up. Yes. I kept sending Cassandra, like, links to listen to her, and she was like...
I listened to it, and I don't hate it. I just need to listen to it more. You know, sometimes you gotta listen to it, like, 3 times. But it's not bad. It's not bad. I like one song on there, and I don't know what it's called, but I'm sure I will become... a big fan over time. She's cute, though. She's cute as fuck. I will say that.
And she's, like, queer, and she, like, believes in, like, the Zodiac or whatever. She's very committed to being a Libra.
Yeah, and I hate Libras, but she's cute. She is, though.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're going to leave you with the song. Thank you for joining us. If you want to book us to come speak at your school, email us at bookings@bitterbrownfemspodcast.com. Or visit bitterbrownfemspodcast.com/bookings. Either one works. Yeah, follow us on all social media. And yeah, have a happy September. I hope you're very productive this Virgo season.
Mm-hmm. And remember, fuck John McCain.
Yeah, remember that. If you take anything else from this podcast, just remember that. Don't worship war criminals.
Don't do it.
All right, bye.